Welcome to the Reality Revolution. I'm your host, Brian Scott. And today we're going to read a short, wonderful, fantastic book called How to Make Money by B.F. Austin. This is the first time I've read anything by B.F. Austin. B.F. Austin was a 19th century Canadian educator, Methodist minister, and spiritualist. He served as the principal of Alma College Girls' School from 1881 to 1897. He wrote many books and was a Methodist minister for a while until he did a sermon on truth, claiming we all should know God by truth and nothing else. And the church was bothered by this, and he was kicked out of the church. He was a famous proponent of the spiritual movement and wrote a number of amazing books. They argued when he was with the Methodist Church that he had gone and visited clairvoyance, and he didn't deny that. So besides all that stuff, just to give you a little bit background about him, he wrote an amazing book called How to Make Money. It's three easy, amazing lessons that you can follow. If you follow these three lessons, you will make money. The way it's written, it talks about a number of things we've talked about in the past in how to gain prosperity, and this is a perfect addition to the Prosperity Revolution playlist. Make sure to check that out. I've read a number of amazing books on how to attract money, how to make money, the secrets to financial success, so many wonderful things, and this is a wonderful addition to that work. How to Make Money by B.F. Austin. Purpose of the lessons. The purpose of these lessons is to raise the mental and spiritual vibrations of the student, to inspire hope, faith, courage, to awaken larger thought within the mind, inspire greater plans and purposes, and awaken the dormant energy in the life to fire the enthusiasm and call into active service hidden talent, which the student possibly does not dream at his present stage of unfoldment he possesses. In short, our purpose is to awaken men from mental slumber, show the unlimited resources in human nature, the unseen yet open doors to mental wealth first, then as a natural sequence to wealth in material conditions, and thus enlarge and ennoble the life as well as add to its material expressions. The purpose of the true teacher, who is ever the true physician as well, must always be the more abundant life of which the Nazarene spoke and taught, to disclose that life, abounding life, in all of its fullness and beauty, and point out the laws by which it is gained, with wealth as a natural sequence, is the purpose of the three lessons on which we are entering. A prophecy of results from these lessons, prophecies based on observation and experience, and knowledge of natural law, are exceedingly instructive and valuable. We predict most confidently that every student of these lessons will have, after reading them, and especially after their rereading and study, a larger store of information on the subject of success in life, brighter hopes, more enthusiasm, more vim, grit, and gumption in business, and will attack his life work with such enlarged wisdom and such intense energy that hereafter his life will become in every way more successful and bring him into larger freedom, greater happiness and power, and ampler resources financially. In short, no one can apply the teachings of these lessons without his life becoming larger, nobler, and purer, and more enjoyable in the possession of mental and material wealth. And the life that receives and applies these teachings will be like a fertilizing stream in the desert, making it bud and blossom like the rose. The reasons for this prophecy. With absolute confidence, I make this prophecy because I shall give you not theories spun from the imagination of the poet or novelist, or from some dreamy philosopher in the seclusion of his study, or some penny a liner who is paid so much per page for his theories, but the actual results of human experience and a study of nature's laws, and especially of the laws of financial gain. I shall give you the kernel of the best teachings of a score of our ablest psychologists and New Thought writers in concentrated form. and I shall give the personal testimony of those who have risen from poverty to wealth through discovery of the laws of financial success and their application to the life. The principles here laid down have been tested over and over again in the laboratory of life's experiences and found correct and practicable. Moreover, I myself have proved them, and I illustrate those principles and prove their value in my own life. Another reason why we most confidently predict success to the students of this course is the fact that the teachings are rational, being in accord with life and human experience, and based on laws that are now known and recognized as governing the accumulation of wealth. These is nothing of mystical charm, no miracle involved, nothing of the cheap nostrum order about them. Our method is simply reason amplified and set to work, energy awakened and employed, laws discovered and followed out with the one inevitable result, enlarged and ennobled character, mental and material wealth. No special endowment required for money making. The way to competence, if not wealth, is open to every man of sound body and mind who will study and apply these laws. The fact that great riches belong to the few, and that some men seem to stumble on riches and others seek them in vain for a lifetime generally without knowledge of the law or application in the life, has led some to suppose that a special endowment of nature is necessary to enable one to attain wealth. Doubtless a few men without a theoretical knowledge of the law have applied it in their lives, and unquestionably some few men seem to come into wealth by chance or luck. Yet there is really no such thing as a chance in a universe of law, and the vast majority of men who have won wealth have either through their own mentality or by the teachings of others or by inspiration come to know the law and apply it in their own lives. Every man of sound mind and body, we repeat, can become master of conditions in his life in place of being enslaved, as the multitudes are by these conditions. There is a pathway from poverty to wealth, from obscurity to fame, from weakness to strength, from the servile and pygmy conditions of mind and life to kingship in mind and in estate. The door of opportunity is open, or at least unlocked. Nature plans abundance for all. Another introductory consideration worthy of our attention is the fact that the evident plan of God as revealed in nature is abundance for all. Poverty is no part of nature's plan, but the very reverse is true. Nature designed abundance for all. Her provision for man's wants covers not only his necessities, but a superabundance is the law of nature's beneficence. The tracing of disease, poverty and suffering to the design of God was indeed a part of the old theology, which is now practically dead and superseded by the new theology, which traces all of these evils to ignorance and neglect of law. As children of God, we inherit not only the right to life, but to all that makes life worth living. But every life is cabined, cribbed, confined by poverty. In fact, freedom, power, happiness, education, culture, travel, books, art, music, recreation, the things that made life worth the living are really impossible without wealth. Not only is our own life robbed of its full and happy expression by poverty, but man's service of his fellow man is limited on every hand by poverty. Men who possess in their own mentality great truths that would instruct and inspire the multitude, or great plans for reforming our deplorable social and economic system, or great purposes of charity toward the needy, or great reforms they would like to see realized, find themselves hampered and hindered in all their noble work by lack of funds. The world, sad to state, estimate a man not by his knowledge or his character so much as by the size of his bank account. A public lecturer said recently in my hearing, and was applauded in saying, that he respected no man who did not have a good bank account. Harsh as this may appear, we shall show there is at least a small measure of justice in it by pointing out that poverty is essentially a mental disease, and that from the standpoint of character itself, in this age of golden opportunity, it is no credit to a man to be poor. Our desires are prophecies and show the possibility of wealth. All students of nature and of man recognize that the possession of a desire within the soul for any real or supposed good is a natural prophecy, proving there is somewhere in nature's realm a source of satisfaction for that desire. If my student then believes in a personal God as the designer of all things, can he possibly conclude that God intended to mock us by desires impossible of fulfillment? If so, as Helen Wilmans aptly declares, these desires implanted within us are simply promissory notes on a ruined bank. Again, if these desires for wealth are not true prophecies, man is destined as he emerges from barbarism to civilization to increasing misery and suffering, since desires multiply and intensify as man advances along the upward path of evolution. All studies, therefore, of nature and the human soul tend to convince us that man's life should have an abundance of temporal good. In short, that man should rule his conditions and not be ruled by them. We go still farther and unhesitatingly assert it is every man's duty to make all the money he can honestly. At first sight, it might seem that inheritors of great wealth, having no need of more money and no love of business or labor, might be excused from the task of money making. Not so, however. Every man who enjoys the advantages of our wonderful civilization, who eats the food some toiler has grown or wears the garments some toiler has made, who enjoys the protection which is freely granted to all, owes a personal debt to the world. Despite his large bank account and broad acres, he is but a refined pauper if in some way he does not add to the wealth of the world. And no man has enough wealth to supply not only his own need, but to fully meet the claims of a world in sickness, suffering, and sorrow, and to plan and prosecute the great living reforms of this age. A man should demand of himself, of society, of his God, abundance of temporal good. The stream of abundance should flow with increasing volume into his life, and the stream of beneficence should flow with equal freedom out of his or her heart and life to supply the higher needs of humanity. Freely receive, freely give. The ideal life is the one in which a liberal kingly income is assured, and man, in the royalty and beneficence of his nature, should give like a king. No life can reach its maximum of enjoyment, power, and usefulness without wealth. Is there great danger in acquiring wealth? Undoubtedly. But greater danger still in the lack of wealth. The one great danger in acquiring money and in possessing it is the danger of becoming a slave to gold. This is one of the vilest forms of slavery, and perhaps no other form of idolatry is quite so benumbing to all the higher and diviner qualities of womanhood and manhood as avarice. The miser is of all characters most despised, and illustrates the truth of the old proverb, money is a good servant, but a hard master. No other type of character exhibits such unreasoning folly and seems so fully to merit the rebuke, thou fool. The one safeguard in the acquisition of wealth is the constant, unremitting cultivation of the human sympathies and the exercise of benevolence. Without this, the acquisition of money is generally attended by a freezing up of the moral nature and a growing love for money for purely selfish purposes or for money's sake, ending in avarice and the wretched condition of the miser. It is quite easy to see how the rigid economy many feel called upon to exercise in rising from poverty to wealth, and the constant mental habit of reaching out in desire and act for material gain, would in the lapse of years work a transformation of character, so that men who set out in life with an ambition to acquire a fortune for the uplift of humanity find with the gaining of the fortune, they have lost all benevolent desire. This is an unspeakable calamity to multitudes of men who become enslaved, not by money, but by the love of money, and miss the grandest opportunity of a life dowered with the possession of money, the privilege of using wealth to enrich themselves and their fellows with that increasing knowledge, happiness, and virtue that constitutes the eternal riches of the soul. Better a thousandfold for a man that he live and die under the disadvantages and limitations and hardships of poverty and retain the spirit of brotherhood and humanity in his heart, than to acquire the wealth of Croesus and shrink his soul up to the littleness, meanness, and wretchedness of a miser. A very good test of our own soul attitudes toward money, a very fair indication of how we would use great wealth if it came to us, may be had in the serious answer of the question, how are we using the measure of wealth which is ours today? How much have we contributed to purely benevolent objects this past year? A man should ever recognize his own kingship and demand a liberal income from the world, and it is his business to see to it that all obstacles in himself and his environment are removed, which would hinder a generous flow of nature's great stream of opulence toward himself. Then he should live like a king and be as generous as a king with his fellow men. We seek to intensify your desires for wealth. In place of encouraging contentment with poverty, we preach the gospel of discontent. We would whet your desires for wealth and intensify your love, not of money, but of the good things in life which money represents. It is a misinterpretation of life and of all true religion to deny either the vast advantages of money on the one hand, or the right and duty of all men to possess and use it in as large a degree as is consistent with honor and justice. The inherent desires of men and women, the demands of the world today upon us in our complex civilization, the law of opulence everywhere seen in nature, all prove that men and women ought to conquer conditions and amass wealth. Lesson 1. The making over of oneself. Our first lesson is introductory, desiring to give the student the right viewpoint of the subject, to enable them to see clearly the relation between character and achievements in life, and to clear the ground for the practical rules and instructions to follow. Our first rule, then, and one of the most important of all, is this: make yourself over. The student of these lessons will very probably interpose this objection. We expected to get practical instructions in money-making, and our teacher is giving us theoretical instruction in the building of character. And for the very good reason that money-making, money-keeping, and right money-using depend on character. Nothing more directly bearing on material interests could be given a student than the upbuilding of a strong, progressive, courageous, and determined character. All real success in life in all departments of human endeavor depends on that. Men conquer material conditions by first conquering themselves. Men become rich in worldly goods by becoming rich in intellectual power, in faith, hope, courage, and in the creative powers of the mind. The outward life is a reflex of the inward life, and no man can become master of the outward and physical realms who does not master the kingdom within. No one is prepared to make wealth, conserve wealth, or rightly use wealth who is in mental poverty, moral weakness, or of a cowardly spirit. The great master of Nazareth knew the order in which happiness, harmony, health, and riches, in fact, all outward good, come into the life, and express it when he said, "Seek first the kingdom that is within, and all these things shall be added unto you." Multitudes of men want results in their lives without the trouble on their part of furnishing the efficient cause. But results do not come from mere wishing. Harvests do not come without the sweat and toil of the laborer and sowing of the seed. All the greatest blessings of life and all our mightiest achievements result from right thinking, right feeling, and right willing. Until a man gets the right conception of the meaning of life, of the unlimited powers of the human soul, until his nature is burning with desire to do and dare and win, until his will is developed by exercise and he has acquired courage and indomitable perseverance, he is poorly equipped for either attaining or rightly using money. It is well worth the student's attention, therefore, to study the relation between strong character and great achievements. Most people have to do considerable judicious weeding in the garden of their minds, getting rid of many inherited and traditional ideas and notions of earlier times, freeing the mentality from fear, worry, doubt, and planting therein the seeds of faith in themselves, in nature, in the law of opulence, faith in their own rights, and developing courage, hope, ambition, and patience, until mentally and spiritually they have rebuilt themselves into a nobler type of being. As man's present outward condition, whether poverty or wealth, happiness or misery, is largely the result of his past methods of thinking, so will the future outward conditions be the direct outgrowth of his future methods of thinking. As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he, which is but another way of saying that man's body is the result of his thinking, conscious or unconscious, his speech, manner, gait, his culture, conduct, his influence among men, his success or failure, all are the natural sequence of his thoughts. How then, you ask, can one make himself over, just as a tailor makes over a coat, a carpenter makes over a house, a shipbuilder makes over a ship by changing the pattern or the design? We build our lives from ideals as the carpenter builds his house from plans. If we change our ideas, our conceptions of life, its privileges and responsibilities, our thoughts of ourselves, our ideals of character, and persist in holding the new ideas and ideals, we shall develop characters in harmony with them. Whatever we want in our outward life in material expression, we must first build into our mental life, into our ideals, purposes, and will. Events, conditions, and seeming results of chance or miracle in our outward life are all under law, and in reality are mostly genuine materializations of forms we have built up in our thought realm. Life proceeds as a stream from the within to the without, from the mental and spiritual to the physical and material expressions. We must therefore create wealth in the mind before we realize its possession in the life. This is not peculiar to the subject of money making, but applies to all life activities, as we see that the architect first builds his house in his mind before he erects it on the material plane. The engineer constructs his tunnel mentally before he pierces the mountain or builds his underground railway. The financial magnate builds his plans of commercial conquest or aggression in the silence and secrecy of his own mind before he takes the first step toward their outward realization. We shall treat this more fully in succeeding pages, sufficient for the student at present to be impressed with the great fact that right ideas and conceptions, right plans and purposes, clear vision of opportunities, a strongly developed power of mental creation, unflinching courage, an adamantine will, and a perseverance that never tires are among the essential requisites in money making. Let me assure the student of these pages that much thought, time, and effort spent in getting a clear grasp of these truths and in weeding out erroneous ideas and impressions from the mind, in getting a right viewpoint of this subject, a right concept of one's own place in nature as Lord and Master, a right view of one's intimate relation to and vital connection with the great source of all wisdom, strength, and goodness, through which he may draw unlimited supplies in all life's honest endeavors, is not wasted, but will prove unspeakable vantage to him or her in conquering poverty and acquiring wealth. These considerations are not incidental or accessory, but vital and fundamental to the subject. The student, therefore, should make a close inspection of their own mental and spiritual equipment for the great struggle they are to enter upon in the conquest of the conditions and limitations of life. Then, they must gain by reflection, study, and experience a clear and lofty ideal of the type of character they would reach, the style of man or woman they must become if they would succeed in the race for wealth, in the battle they would fight to rise from the cabined, cribbed, and confined conditions of poverty to the enjoyment and power of great wealth. He will doubtless find himself in possession of qualities of mind and traits of character not only useless, but positively detrimental to success in life. These he must, no matter how great the effort or long the struggle, eliminate. Then he will find other mental qualities and characteristics essential to success conspicuous by their absence or by very faint expressions in his life. There he must develop, nourish, exercise, and call into strength and beauty. The work of making oneself over is a threefold work, a thorough diagnosis of our own mental, moral, and spiritual equipment for the battle before us, elimination of undesirable ideas, characteristics, habits, etc., and the cultivation of the undeveloped germs of mental and spiritual qualities essential to success. This threefold work of preparation is as rational and essential to one seeking wealth as the careful study of the mental qualities, the physical endowment, and the rigid training of the athlete before a contest as necessary as the discipline, training, and equipment of the soldier in war. The man who thinks himself qualified without his threefold mental discipline to enter upon the fierce competitions and tremendous difficulties in his struggle for his share of worldly good is as truly a fool as the man who untrained wages war with the athlete in the arena. No one but a fool expects the harvest without toil and seed sowing. Only the fool expects results without adequate cause. Right ideas, views of life, right conceptions of your own powers, right ideals and purposes, the right courage and will, and the right hope and spirit constitute the adequate cause for the result we call success. They are the fruitful seed of the harvest you wish to reap. The student cannot be too deeply impressed with the necessity of this mental and spiritual preparation. In this making over process, time, money, effort, and zeal are well expended. Every teacher who can give you a fruitful idea, every book that can bring a real inspiration, every exercise of mental gymnastics that can strengthen the will, every ray of light that can give you a clear vision of the true ideals is of priceless value to you. Poverty is a mental disease. Of course, there are exceptional cases where from some misfortune or wrongdoing of others, poverty seems forced upon an individual, either by uncontrollable circumstances in his own life or by the action of others. Yet in the vast majority of cases, the poverty of man's material condition is the natural and inevitable result of poverty in himself, in his thought realm of reasoning, emotion, and volition. The mental poverty is mother and father of the poverty of his material conditions. The outward conditions of a man's life are a reflex of his thought world. This view of the case will help the student in his resolve to thoroughly diagnose the condition of his thought realm and to bring his mental machinery into such a state of efficiency that his whole character will assume a nobler type, and with the natural result that his outer condition shall reflect his improved mentality. Eliminate wrong ideas, ideals, and moods. Among the erroneous notions which it may be necessary to root out of the mind is the thought, traceable to false religious teaching, that the possession of much money is not in harmony with true religion. It is quite true that the love of money is a root of evil, and that many who have great wealth are under great temptations to neglect their spiritual interests. But note this fact, that while money loved and worshipped and money hoarded by miserly avarice are great evils and a source of great temptation, poverty, on the other hand, has its peculiar evils and temptations, and that no position in life is free from possible temptation. while every blessing in life by abuse, many become a curse. Note also that the evident design of nature is abundance and not poverty, so that while we may say God is the author of beneficence and abundance, and nature's law is certainly opulence, no one can say God is the author of poverty. The end nature aims at it is abundance for all, and if we must find an origin for poverty, we can never trace it to divine design. The notion that sickness, suffering, and poverty are in any way necessarily related to a religious life is one of the falsest teachings ever given out in the name of religion. God is the author of health, happiness, wealth, and wisdom, and sickness, misery, poverty, ignorance are incidents of our undeveloped condition or result of our own neglect. No life under the blighting influence of poverty can prove the abundant life, the full-orbed, symmetrical, and beneficent life which every rational man desires. The worry fiend and his allies must be routed if you are to secure that peace and inward calm so essential to efficient thinking and working. Psychology Today, in trumpet tones, declares that no one can enjoy health who is a victim of worry, anger, jealousy, or fear. Along with these, we should put irresolution, timidity, depression, lack of confidence in oneself, all of them negative emotions, utterly unfitting us for the conflict of life. These emotions exhaust the life energy and leave a man or woman only fractional strength for the stubborn ordeals of life. People suffer more real exhaustion and loss from the evils they fear, but which never happen, than they do from the evils that actually materialize in their lives. At an old man's funeral, it was said of him he had a multitude of troubles in life, most of which never happened. What an infinite pity that the time and strength which might be utilized in grand achievements for ourselves and the world are too often wasted in worry, fear, or envy, with the one result of weakness and suffering and lost opportunities of usefulness. Fear has been called truly the great hobgoblin of the race. It magnifies our foes and minifies our friends. It is always saying, there is a lion in the way. Its cry is the cry of coward servant of Elisha. Alas, my master, what shall we do? It sees the foes, difficulties, and magnifies them into gigantic proportions. The tearful and the unbelieving both go to the same doom according to Scripture. And the whole progress of humanity, nationally and individually, is a progress from the dominion of fear to the realm of faith. Fear has a strange magnetic power, a thought-creative power of materializing into our outward life the very objects feared. It seems to be a magnet with great force, drawing into the orbit of the life the very object feared by the mind. The thing that I feared, said the sacred writer, is that which came upon me. Faith, on the other hand, says with Elisha, they that are for us are greater than those that be against us. Faith sees the angelic hosts ready to assist us in time of need. Let the student remember the axiom, thought takes form in action and being. The way to drive out worry, fear, etc. In place of centering our thought upon the worry, fears, doubts, and irresolution, which constitute man's mental poison, the proper method is to forget that these have controlled us and put all our mental effort into the cultivation of their antidotes. Peace, trust, faith, resolution, courage, the expulsive power of a new and contrary idea or affection is recognized by all psychologists, and from the standpoint of mental science, we should not allow the mind to dwell upon undesirable qualities or things. Think health, not sickness, success, not failure. Courage, not fear, faith, not doubt, the increasing good coming into your life, not the evil. Especially is it necessary to enlarge and strengthen faith, which is not a mere belief or assent of the understanding to certain statements, but as Edward E. Beals expresses it, faith is the trolley pull which one raises to meet the great forces of life and nature, and by means of which one receives the inflow of the power which is behind and in all things, and is enabled to apply that power to the running of his own affairs. The illustration is most apt and forcible. faith is the vital bond of connection between the soul of man and its infinite source of supply. It is more, it is the great awakener of the latent forces in the soul of man. To the sick, it uncaps the fountain of healing waters in the soul and floods the whole spiritual nature with new life and power. To the weak, it brings strength. To the timid, courage. To the despairing, hope. Faith opens the soul's interior vision and discloses the realities of the spirit realm, realities that being recognized and patiently waited for the strange power of materializing themselves in our outward life conditions. We must assiduously cultivate faith in ourselves. No man ever becomes truly successful who is deeply impressed with his own weakness or inferiority. It is the confident, hopeful men who carry with them the thought vibration, I can and I will, who win in life's battles. If a man could keep his poor opinion of himself to himself, even then it would cripple him in his life work. But the more surely does it do so because every one's fear thoughts, however zealously he may seek to hide them in language or conduct, create an atmosphere of doubt, timidity and fear about him that radiates into the minds of all who come in contact with him. Thoughts and moods are catching. No man can keep his thoughts entirely to himself. The air of negativity, of doubt and irresolution with which multitudes of men and women surround themselves finds their way into other minds and becomes a barrier to success at every point. This lack of confidence in yourself, however, is most disastrous in its effects upon yourself, as it is a frost which kills all the building plans, purposes, and hopes which are so essential to success. Get rid of them, I beg of you, of all false notions as to the limitations of your own powers, for while it is quite true you have only developed these powers to a very limited extent, and there seems to be a very great difference between your life and the lives of great men, remember, there is absolutely no limit to the extent to which your powers may be unfolded. You are vitally connected to the storehouse of divine wisdom, power, and strength, and can draw at will and to any extent, for in God we live and have our being. Potentially, therefore, you have more ability, undeveloped and unused, in your nature than all men of all the ages have ever exhibited. Cultivate, too, faith in the power that makes for righteousness, in the angelic wisdom and help, in a higher guiding intelligence in your life, in destiny, or your guiding star, as the great souls who have been world leaders have done. Cultivate absolute faith, too, in the laws which you are now mastering of financial success. And remember that the throne of God is no more stable, the revolution of the sun no more certain, the law of gravitation no more a fixture than is the operation of these fixed laws of financial increase. With faith in self, in your fellows, in the law, hold your head erect, assert to your own soul your mastery of conditions, and with confidence of the I can and I will spirit, enter life's arena. Helena Willmans, of whose remarkable career we shall have more to say later, declares, I made myself over completely. From being like a limp rag, I became sufficiently positive to conquer all my environments. In another place, she declares, I became as a god and knew that no power could come against me. Claim for yourself unlimited power and wisdom. Until a man or woman gets at least a glimpse into the depths of human nature, they can never realize themselves or life's possibilities. So long as they measure themselves and set limitations on their forces, so long will they limit their achievements and all their life expressions. The true view is that no one can measure a man or woman's greatness, and that is your greatness, any more than they can fix a limit to God's greatness. Men and women are children of God, started on an eternal progression, is germinally at least a god. And the clearer their vision of this truth, the more constant their recognition of the fact, the faster will divinity manifest in their character and life. Every man and woman, and that means you, contains germinally at least not only all the attributes of human greatness, all the talent, ability, genius, which men and women have ever given expression to in history, but also the fullness of divinity. The human race is a family of the gods. You have, therefore, not one talent, but the whole of the human endowment. You have genius, which is but concentrated energy and persevering willpower. You have all power, even as Jesus declared of himself, you are more than able to conquer. Hold this thought. It means success. Lesson 2. Principles and methods of success. Keep body and mind in tip-top condition. If the mind is weakened by worries, vain regret, forebodings, or your mental forces spent in the inharmonious vibrations of envy, hatred, distrust, or malice, or if the body is weakened by violations of natural law or by excesses, overindulgences in appetite, passion, etc., or if the mind and body are not in harmonious relation on nature's plan for their harmonic working, do not expect success. He who cannot conquer the world within cannot conquer the world without. He who cannot regulate himself cannot rule over conditions and other people. The promise is, he that overcometh shall inherit all things. But it is also said that a house divided against itself cannot stand. In the first class condition of mind and body, and their harmonious working on nature's plan, which we shall presently explain, is developed the power to tide one over difficulties, to triumph over conditions of inheritance, poor environment, and seemingly insuperable obstacles, and win one's way steadily to the heights of success. This strength in constant increase can be brought into your life if you will keep a free and clear mind in a healthy and vigorous body, working in harmony with the divine plan of nature. Do you ask me what the plan is? It is revealed in the location of the origins of the brain, where you can find those representing the appetites and passions at the base of the brain, those representing intellectual powers higher up, and near the crown, those representing the spiritual faculties in the crown of the head. This shows the body is subject to the mind. Both mind and body should be subservient to the spiritual nature. On this plan, you can organize your life and secure harmony, and harmony means peace and power, without which you can never conquer the world. A life and character built upon any other plan must be discordant, weak, chaotic, since the spiritual nature can never take a subservient place. It is God's plan of organizing your life. Make the mind positive, therefore, toward the body. The spiritual nature should rule all departments of the life. Let reason dictate how time, money, energy be spent, just how far appetite should be indulged, hours for labor, sleep, recreation, and through all life's activities, let there run a high spiritual purpose to make the most and best of life for yourself and accomplish the most good for humanity. Avoid all waste of time, money, and energy. Closely related to the above is the careful conservation of life's resources and opportunities. It has been said by someone that time is money, but time is infinitely more than money. Time improved spells character, and character means destiny, so the wasting of time is infinitely greater prodigality than the waste of money. Let no reader mistake me. I'm no advocate of constant work, believing that rest, recreation, and amusement are as necessary as food and exercise, especially to real workers. Yet it is the unfortunate fact that most of the recreation and amusement are not sought by the workers, but by the idlers. Good judgment must determine when the mind and body need recreating, and time and money thus spent are not wasted but used to good advantage. But so much time and money are needlessly spent by multitudes where mind and body do not require the sacrifice that it seems pitiable from the standpoint of self-improvement to see so much of life frittered away. The hours spent needlessly by men and boys, if improved in study or practice, would soon mean greater efficiency in labor, better wages, shorter hours, and comfort, if not affluence. Money spent on cigars, occasional drinks, or other useless expenditures, if saved and invested, would soon give the very capital required as the foundation of a fortune. And how much human strength and magnetic force is wasted by many in idle talk or senseless activity or sensual indulgence that would give vigor to the blow, conviction, and power to the statement or charm and winning force to the personality if conserved in place of wasted. Thousands of men go to business every day depleted of the very vital and magnetic forces necessary to success because they have not had moral courage and strength to govern the body and its passions in place of being governed by them. Overindulgence in this regard has ruined many a man's prospects for life. The conservation of the vital germinal forces in the human body gives light to the eye, charm to the voice, magnetic power to the personality, and that indefinable yet most potential ability to find one's way into the good graces and wishes of others upon which success so largely depends. If you want to win, go to business, to the office, to the conference, or to the public meeting, brimming full of vitality, and people will realize without any act on your part that a king is in their midst. Cultivate seership in business. There is such a thing as business clairvoyance, and to be successful, a man must develop this inner vision of the soul so that he can discover the doors of opportunity, the pathways around him leading to success. He must cultivate alertness of mind, close powers of observation, careful study of present and prospective conditions, and set his imagination at work in constructive planning for success. In the silence, a man must commune with his own soul and with present conditions, and then build up mentally better possible conditions for the future. A stolid multitude crosses the continent, but having eyes to see, they see not. The open doors to wealth in the unused water power, in the desert convertible into a paradise by a stream of water, in the outcropping are convertible into an El Dorado, and having ears to hear, they hear not the many voices calling for the strong arm of labor and the fertile mind to change the wilderness into a garden of roses. One man in a thousand possesses business clairvoyance as a natural gift. Others, by attention, care, and study, can develop it. And to those who thus find the door of opportunity, the rest is easy. Zizito myself, auto-suggestion. Undoubtedly, the most remarkable discovery in psychology in our times is the wonderful power of suggestion in the formation of character and the awakening of the soul's powers. It has been found that our lives are ruled to a large extent by suggestion, i.e. by the impressions made upon the mind, by what we see, hear, and sense, or by telepathic action of other minds. This is true of men generally, and in the ordinary waking state, that they are ruled and governed more largely in this way than would at first sight seem possible. Under suggestion received from without or by telepathy, men often do what they had not planned, what in some cases they had not dared to do, and often with most surprising results to themselves and to others. Under suggestion, men have undertaken tasks that ordinarily would have appalled them, sometimes meeting with phenomenal success, sometimes developing in the very novel attempts thus inspired powers of mind and body they did not believe themselves to possess, and often gathering to themselves new strength and inspiration in their life work. While this is true of suggestion received in the normal working state, it is found that suggestion given to one in sleep or in the hypnotic condition enters more deeply into the nature, affects the life much more powerfully, and has a most surprising and seemingly magical effect in calling out the latent powers and talents of the soul. Indeed, the records of the results of suggestion are so wondrous that it may be looked upon as the real Aladdin lamp of modern times in psychology. Its effects are seen not only in a changed and strengthened mental condition, greater courage, faith, daring, and ability, but its marvelous result on the human body are now fully recognized in the cure of disease, the conquest of the drink and opium habit, and the general regeneration of the human system. Educators of the new school and all students of the new psychology know it to be one of the most efficient instruments in the building of character and the proper training of children. Through its power, parents today, by mental suggestion to their sleeping children, are building up a loftier type of manhood and womanhood for the future endured with powers of mind and body surpassing those of the past days. While all this and much more is true of suggestion, and many are silently curing the sick and reforming the vicious by proper suggestions administered to them in sleep, it is not generally known that the same wonderful power may be applied by a person to himself by what is known as auto-suggestion. The great subconscious mind, which is not a second mind or a separate mind, but that most reservoir of subjective mental activities, which is continually active, which works automatically, which reasons only deductively, which presides over all the vital functions, digestion, circulation, respiration, secretion, nutrition, etc., and rules us absolutely in sleep and hypnosis, is amenable to suggestion by our normal waking consciousness. All our ordinary thinking, our experience of every kind, constitute suggestions to the subjective mind, which receives them as the hopper receives all grain and forthwith proceeds to grind them up into material for the building of our minds and into patterns and ideals for the rebuilding of our bodies. So we are constantly furnishing these suggestions to the subjective mind and constantly rebuilding mind and body according to suggestions given. If then we want health, vigor, soundness of body, strong mentality, great courage, faith, and willpower, we must make suggestions along these lines by constantly affirming to ourselves the possession of these qualities, and assuredly we will find them developed in our characters and abundantly manifest in our lives. A fixed idea of health, happiness, success implanted in the mind by this power of auto-suggestion is worth more than a fortune to any man or woman. In this way, we should, by a steady habit of auto-suggestion, fix in the subjective mind the strongest capable faith in our own ability. Dr. Quackenboss of Columbia University has accomplished seemingly miraculous results in developing great ability in music and art in boys and girls in a few months by suggestion, which would ordinarily have taken years of training, and which ability might never have manifested under any length of training but for the strange power which suggestion has called out the latent powers of the soul. Suggestions given to a pupil under hypnosis are accepted with unquestioned faith, and faith seems to have a mysterious power of healing and inspiring, and especially of awakening talent lying dormant. Men generally can do what they believe they can do, and they cannot do what they believe they cannot do. We see this in the hypnotized boy, who, being told he cannot cross a certain line on the floor, struggles in vain to cross it, his belief holding him in captivity and utterly suppressing his natural physical powers. On the other hand, I have frequently heard the hypnotized lad, under suggestion that he was a noted orator, arise and deliver a surprising address of which he was utterly incapable in his normal state. And I have seen the hypnotized subject leap over a man's head under the stimulus of suggestion, a feat he could not possibly accomplish in his waking state. No one knows the reserve powers of the mind. If you would awaken them, you must cultivate daily, by auto-suggestion, unlimited faith in yourself. Lesson 3. Principles and methods of success. Make the world your debtor. Heaven will repay. We know not how much faith the pupil may have in the unseen universe or in the agency of unseen intelligences in mortal life, yet we shall venture to state the law of financial success, which has come down to us from very ancient sources and is believed by many to have had an occult origin. In fact, it purports to be a teaching revealed in these later days from a noted Hindu scientist of 4,000 years ago. It professes to be the law of worldly increase as seen from the standpoint of spirit life. And it is stated above in the caption of this paragraph, make the world your debtor. By serving humanity in every way, but especially on the highest possible plane of service, the spiritual. Make the debt as great as possible. Do all the good you can, every time you can, everywhere you can, in every way you can, and to every man. The underlying thought is that the angels who administer God's providence here on the mortal plane and are guardians over humanity, will accept as done unto themselves every act of kindness to mortals, and endeavor to repay not only in spiritual but also in temporal good. The thought of the kindly sympathy and help of the angels of God must bring strength and cheer to every worker for human good. Great ideas and projects interest great minds. Most lives, as we have already pointed out, are poor and mean in their outward expression and conditions because the individuals are mentally poor and poverty-stricken. Little thoughts, plans, ideals beget little interest, little effort, little zeal in the individual and awaken little or no interest in other minds. The radical difference between the popcorn man on the corner and the captain of industry or the financial magnate is in the size of their ideas and conceptions. Popcorn ideas beget a popcorn life. Great ideas, projects, enterprises, on the other hand, rouse the soul of the individual to zeal, effort, courage, daring commensurate with the great ideas. Great men cannot be approached with any project of a trifling character. Time and mental force are too valuable to waste on things not worthwhile. If we accept the theory of an overshadowing spiritual universe thronged with guardian intelligences of humanity, we may well believe that the noblest intelligences over there will not enter into the alliance with any mortal here who is not doing something worthwhile. A man should continually plan greater and still greater enterprises for himself, should have the courage and daring to embark upon these new enterprises, trusting in the unfolding powers of their own soul, in the great law of evolution, in the angelic help, and in the star of destiny to crown his efforts with success. Great ideas and projects, if accompanied by sound judgment, proper plans, and proportionate zeal, produce great men and great success. Cultivate strength of willpower. The will is the directive faculty of the soul, and when in harmony with nature, may become the channel of personal and spiritual energy, as real as the force of gravitation or electricity. If wrongly directed, it cannot of itself ensure success. For the human will must ever be subject to and in harmony with the divine will. Some teachers and writers speak as though the individual man simply by willpower could set aside the laws of nature or thwart the divine will as expressed in general law. Not so. As well assert that a man by taking hold of his bootstraps could lift himself over a mountain. But where a man wills truth and righteousness or formulates any great plan in harmony with nature's ordination, the will of man thus becomes one with the universal will, which is a channel of the divine forces of the universe. There seems to be no real limit to human achievement in harmony with nature's laws if pursued unfalteringly by a strong and unconquerable will. The basis of all personal power resides in this will. All great and successful characters possess it in the high degree. A strong will is a mighty cyclonic force in human nature that creates a current of vibrations toward its possessor, along which are brought to him the very objects willed. It operates by natural law, yet its results seem at times miraculous. The pupil should, by frequent affirmation to himself in the temple of his own soul, assert his will and ability to conquer all difficulties. Many have suggested this affirmation for constant use: I can and I will. The human will, that force unseen, the offspring of a deathless soul, can hew a way to any goal, though walls of granite intervene. It was this willpower, developed in high degree, which transformed the little Corsican into the most magnificent military leader and conqueror the world ever saw, Napoleon Bonaparte. He would regard nothing as impossible, insisting that the word impossible was only found in the dictionary of fools. It was not a French word at all. When told that the Alps stood in the way of his victorious march into Italy, he simply said, "There shall be no Alps," and the Simplon Pass was the result. Keep a watchful eye for opportunities. The seeker of wealth must keep all his mental faculties alert in watching for openings, chances, favorable tides, and be fertile enough in plans and bold enough in courage to turn them to account. Once to every man and nation comes the moment to decide, Shakespeare says. There is a tide in the affairs of men, which, taken at its flood, leads on to fortune. A man should be ready in advance for these open doors. The man in service should always be ready for a higher post. He who does not more than fill his position is not fitted for a higher one. Read the lives of men who have risen from the lowest to the highest rung of the ladder, and you will find men who have prepared themselves in advance and by extra service prepared their own advance. When the door opens, enter. When opportunity comes your way, seize her by the forelock, for as the ancients declared, she is bald behind. The Spanish have a motto: half the misfortune in life comes from holding in one's horse when he is leaping. Remember, money comes from doing. The pupil will bear in mind that if great stress has been laid on right thinking, feeling, willing, and much labor spent in the psychology of the subject, it is all with one object in view: right action at the right time. Nothing can take the place of patient, plodding industry. Ideas expressed in action, zeal, will power, faith, and energy translated into work. Helen Wilmans says most truly, money comes from doing. Wallace D. Wattles' practical ideas. In a little pamphlet, How to Get What You Want, Mr. Wallace D. Wattles gives some very valuable and pertinent advice on money making, as well as on other lines of success. We summarize a few of his most practical teachings. The cause of success is always in the person who succeeds. All minds are formed of the same essential elements and contain the same faculties. The difference in men is the degree of their development. It is certain, therefore, that you can succeed if you can find out the cause of success, develop it to sufficient strength, and apply it properly in your work. You can develop any power to an unlimited extent. Therefore, you can develop enough success power to succeed. You must develop special faculties to be used in your own special work. You must choose for a business the one which will call for the use of your strongest faculties, and then develop these strongest faculties to the highest point possible. Success depends not alone or chiefly on the possession of these special faculties, which are only the tools of success, but more upon the power which uses the tools. This something in the person which causes him to use his special faculties successfully, we call active power consciousness. It is poise, and more than poise, it is faith, and more than faith, it is what you feel when you know you can do a thing and know how to do the thing. You must learn how to create this power consciousness so you will know you can do what you want to do. You must not only believe you can succeed, but must also know you can succeed, and the subconscious mind must know you can succeed as well as the objective mind. People may think objectively they can succeed, but subconsciously doubt that they will, and the subconscious doubt will thwart success. The subconscious mind must be thoroughly impregnated with the knowledge that you have the power and know how to use it and will use it. Repeated affirmations for a month, especially just before sleep, of such statements as the following will help you create the subconscious knowledge of success. I can succeed. I am successful. What others have done, I can do. I can do what I want to do. I can have what I want to have. To get more, you must make the best constructive use of what you have. Progress depends on the perfection of your use of what you have. The squirrel, by jumping through the law of evolution in time, obtains wings. You will never have wings if you only jump half as far as you can. Every person who does one thing perfectly is instantly presented with an opportunity of doing some larger thing. The law is that whatever an organization has more life than can find expression by functioning on a given plane, its surplus life lifts it to the next higher plane. Live for the future now, but do not live in the future now. Get more business, more friends, better position by using constructively what you have now. Concentrate all your constructive energies on the use of what you have today. Make every transaction, experience, even the adverse ones, a stepping stone to nobler things. Remember, it is the surplus of life, ability on one plane, which under evolution prepares for the next higher plane. Make friends by taking a real interest in everyone you meet. Fill perfectly every present relation and be ready in advance for the promotion sure to come. How Helen Willmans conquered poverty. Lives of great men and of great women as well all remind us we can make our lives sublime. No truth in words impresses us so strongly as the truth in a life. Helen Willmans' story is a Bible of revelations for the age in which we live fully of the new thought, the new theology, and the divinest inspiration. Mrs. Willmans declares that fear is at the bottom of poverty, fear of others, and distrust of self. She declares, "I have known poverty most thoroughly. I was held in a belief of its power all through the earlier part of my life. I looked to others as my superiors. I was ready to take a place beneath them. I was tortured day and night by actual want. Then my reasoning powers began to awaken, first on the subject of religion, then on other things, and my mind broke its fetters, so I began to see the light. I threw off 100 beliefs considered essential to salvation. I slowly acquired a measure of individuality that enabled me to stand alone." Read the story of her life. It is thrilling and most instructively interesting. A farmer's wife, the farm mortgaged and then sold, in poverty, all her possessions in a valise, without money, securing a ride to a town 5 miles distant, whence the $10 borrowed money, wrenched by mental force from a shoemaker, she proceeds to Frisco, spends her capital, fasts for 3 days, refuses, though hungry, any work or job, save what she has set her heart upon, newspaper work, which at last she secures at $6 a week, then loses, gains another place. Then one day she throws down her pen and marches out of the office, determined to serve others no longer. She stands alone in the sleet and snow of the street, her sole capital 25 cents and her own self-reliance, and resolves to found a newspaper of her own. She goes home, and the boarding housekeeper, suspicious of her early return, asks, "Have you been discharged by the chief?" "No," she answers, "I have discharged the chief." "Is your bread and butter assured?" he asks. "My bread and butter are assured," she answered. "How?" he asks. "I'm going to found a paper, and it is a success before it is born. Listen, and I'll read you my first editorial." Then she read him her editorial on I, and he sat listening to the burning enthusiasm and the ringing clarion tones of freedom and aggressiveness, till his soul was on fire and his face illuminated, and he cried out, "I'll gamble on you. I have $20,000 in the bank. You can draw on every dollar if you like." She refused, but asked him to wait for a short time for her board bill. 3 days later, when $7 came in, they danced with joy around the table till the dishes were scattered and broken. Then followed more subscriptions, donations, appreciation, larger hopes, plans, courage, and success. She conquered poverty by conquering fear, learning of and trusting in herself, and daring to say, "I can and I will." Planning. One great secret of success in life is careful, wise, and prudent planning of our labors in advance. Perhaps in no one thing does the successful man surpass the unsuccessful more in the ability to foresee the future, prepare and arrange his plans to meet its exigencies, and to so direct his labors to avoid loss of time, money, and energy, and make all his work bear directly on the attainment of his great purpose. All great generals, Caesar, Hannibal, Napoleon, Wellington, Grant, have excelled in ability to lay out practical plans of campaign, and in a multitude of great battles, the victory has been more largely by skillful, bold, and decisive planning than by the use of superior force. What is the chief thing in good planning? We answer that the first essential is knowledge. Take the general about to engage the enemy's forces in battle. What does he need especially for the formation of his plans of battle? Chiefly knowledge. He needs to know fully the forces arrayed against him. He needs to know accurately the forces at his command. He needs to know the weak and strong points of both armies. He needs to know every foot of the ground over which the battle may rage. And in short, the more complete and accurate his knowledge, the better plan of battle can he lay out, and the greater his prospect of success. The architect before building must know the nature of the site, quality of material, figure out the cost, take into account the element of time and weather, and in short, build his structure completely in mind before he builds it in mortar, as the successful general must fight out in the mental arena his battle before he successfully fights the enemy. So every young person in planning his life work needs, especially, knowledge. First, he needs to know himself physically, intellectually, and morally, his strength and weaknesses, his tastes, inclinations, and special talents. The next essential in successful planning is such a scheme as will recognize all the great facts and factors entering into the life. Every young man should study himself, know his own ability, find out his own talent and special inclinations, and then lay out, as a general does, his order of battle, as an architect does his building, his life plan. A large class of young men and women seem to have formulated no plans, schemes, purposes beyond the present and immediate future. Not long since I heard a distinguished man giving one great reason for his success, and he had risen under very adverse influences from ignorance and poverty to wide knowledge and a position of great honor and power, in these words: "When as a country lad I entered college in my teens, I laid out carefully in advance a course of 5 years in arts and 4 following years in theology. I was poor and had to earn my money during the vacations by editorial work during the college year, and labored under great disadvantages in other respects. Yet my careful, matured plans I followed out through 9 years without deviation, and if I have met with success in my life, it has been largely owing to my ability to plan my work carefully and then stick to my plans until I had completed them." The right use of difficulties. There is no better test of character than a man's treatment of difficulties. The coward shuns them. The lazy man tries to go around them. The idler dawdles in front of them, waiting like Micawber for something to turn up or some miracle to remove them. The baby man waits for some friend to lift him over them, but the manly man surmounts them. There are 2 important questions for young men and women. How are we to think about our difficulties? How are we to treat our difficulties? 1. How are we to think about the difficulties we meet in this life? This is a question of vast importance, for upon its correct solution depends largely our happiness and our success. We should never look upon difficulties as misfortunes. They are often, and when rightly used, always among our greatest blessings. Difficulties encountered start the mind to active enterprise, develop the inventive genius, spur us to exertion, summon our resources, and exercise them for growth and enlargement. Difficulties are to young people what the wind is to the young oak: nature's method of causing us to lay hold more deeply on her strength and grow stronger fiber in our mental and moral being. Difficulties furnish us our grandest opportunities, becoming, as they do, the great incentive and inspiration to our undeveloped forces. They call forth our reserve power. They are heaven-ordained instrumentalities for awakening the slumbering powers within us to life and activity. A young man with many difficulties in his way ought to thank God and take courage. He should spell the word difficulties, but should pronounce it opportunities. 2. How are we to treat our difficulties? First, we must face them squarely. Many of life's difficulties are more imaginary than real. They dwindle to insignificance the moment we gaze resolutely upon them. Study them as carefully as you would an opponent in battle, whom you are determined to conquer. Learn all you can from friend and foe about the difficulties you are encountering. Remember, you are born to conquer and resolve to be a victor. Let there be no shunning, no whining, no waiting, no sickly babyish dependence on others. Your own right hand, your own strong heart, your own indomitable will, these can give you the victory. Take your difficulties as the athletes take their hard and rigid training with a welcome, and remember, each difficulty conquered means more strength. Read the history of the world's greatest men and women and see how they conquered poverty, prejudice, and opposition, how they triumphed over bodily weakness, out of weakness were made strong through difficulties, and how they overcome mental and moral deficiencies and rose up giants from the contests and victors in the battle and became men of whom the world was no worthy, because they overcame difficulties. Conquer your difficulties, and you have conquered the world. Self-assertion as a success factor. Many a well-educated man of good address and ability fails to win a satisfactory position in life because he lacks self-assertion. He has a shrinking nature and abhors publicity. The thoughts of pushing himself forward is repugnant to him, and so he is left behind in the race by the hustling, stirring, vigorous people around him, many of whom do not possess one-tenth of his ability or natural advantages. Many young people have a totally mistaken conception of the meaning of healthy aggressiveness. They frequently confound it with egotistic boastfulness, decry it as a lack of modesty, and consider it the sign of petty, vulgar souls. They think it unbecoming to try to make a good impression in regard to their own ability and shrink from public gaze, believing that if they work hard, even in retirement, they will come out all right. As a matter of fact, however, in this competitive age, it is not only indispensable to have our mental storehouses well stocked with superior goods, but it is also necessary to advertise them. For even an inferior article, if well advertised, will often sell rapidly, while a superior one without advertisement will sell at a dead loss. No one sympathizes with the blatant, conceited, overconfident youth who has the list of his accomplishments and virtues at his tongue's end and inflicts them on anyone he can induce to listen. He is the very opposite of the unassuming young man who, while conscious of his power, makes no parade of it, but simply carries himself as if he knew his business thoroughly. When questioned as to what he can do, a modest, self-assertive person does not give weak, hesitating answers, saying, "I think I can do that," or "perhaps I could do it," creating a feeling of doubt, not only in his own mind, but also in that of his questioner, which undoubtedly acts to his disadvantage. He knows he can do certain things, and he says so with a confidence that carries conviction. This is the sort of self-assertion or self-confidence that young men and women must cultivate if they would raise themselves to their full value. It is a quality as far removed from vulgar, shallow self-conceit as the calm exercise of conscious power is from charlatanism. Thousands of young men and young women are occupying inferior positions today because of their over-humility, so to speak, or fear of seeming to put themselves forward. Many of them are conscious that they are much abler than the superintendents or managers over them, and are consequently dissatisfied, feeling that an injustice has been done them because they have been passed over in favor of more aggressive workers. They have only themselves to blame. They've been too modest to assert themselves or to assume responsibility when occasion has warranted, thinking that in time their real ability would be discovered by their employers and that they would be advanced accordingly. But a young man with vim and self-confidence who courts responsibility will attract the attention of those above him and will be promoted when a retiring, self-effacing, but much abler youth who worked beside him is passed by. It is useless to say that merit ought to win under any circumstances. The fact remains there is very little chance for a young man or woman, no matter what their ability, to forge ahead if they lack a just appreciation of themselves and are destitute of that consciousness of power and willingness to assume responsibility, which impresses their personality on others and opens the door to recognition of their merit. 'Tis true, 'tis pity, and pity 'tis true, that modest worth that retires from the public gaze and works in secret, waiting to be discovered and to have prizes thrust upon it, waits in vain. The world moves too fast in this 20th century, or 21st, to turn aside to seek out shrinking ability. We must all go to the world. We need not delude ourselves with the idea that it will come to us, no matter how able or meritorious we may be. While actual inability can never hope to hold its own, even though through self-conceit and aggressive methods it may succeed in pushing its way ahead for a time, it is equally true that shrinking, self-effacing ability rarely comes to its own success. And this concludes How to Make Money by B.F. Austin. Three simple lessons three simple lessons that you can take from this. First of all, make yourself over. Transform yourself. If you're in a place you're not happy about your finances, make the one commitment that you're going to completely change yourself. Your every habit, your every thought, your way of being, the way you clean your room, the way you make your bed, everything. Make yourself over. It's the most important lesson. When you do it, it will change your life. It will begin to change the way you see your prosperity expressed in your life. Secondly, keep the mind and the body in tip-top condition, working out, exercising, and then auto-suggestion. You're eating also what you're giving your mind. So accessing positive information on a regular basis with auto-suggestion, telling yourself that large sums of money come to me easily and quickly, in increasing quantities from multiple sources on a continuous basis, in the best interest of all that I get to keep. Telling yourself that on a regular basis as you go to sleep works, because you'll start to see large sums of money coming to you easily and quickly in increasing quantities from multiple sources on a continuous basis. It's an amazing, mind-blowing, wonderful thing that I love about these teachings and so much else. I resonated with everything in this, and it's such a simple and easy lesson. The lesson on how to make money is really told in just a couple of paragraphs. But what you get here is a little bit more, explaining to you how to take into consideration your outside circumstances and what's going on with you, the nature of the universe itself being absolute abundance. You deserve abundance. This universe is meant to be abundant, and you deserve to have that abundance. There should be no religious belief that you need to be poor, that being rich is immoral in any way, shape, or form. But the third lesson is the most important, and that is to be of service. If you can be of service, you can find the greatest wealth. Heaven will repay you. By giving as much as you can, by being of service, you'll find that you'll be of the greatest wealth. The little thing at the end from Wallace D. Wattles is great, and we may go back and look at that entire pamphlet because it's fantastic. In any case, my inner part of me is imagining all the time for you to conquer poverty if that's what you're going through, to overcome difficulties if that's what you're going through, and to find absolute wealth and joy. And you deserve it. It's the life that you deserve, to travel the world, to eat the best foods, to go to the best cities, to meet the best people. And you deserve all of it. You deserve every single bit of it. And I just want you to allow yourself to have this wealth. And when you do, and it's not hard, just go out and do something. Take an action, as they're implying at the end. Take an action. Don't sit and wait for it to come. But it will come easily, just a little bit. Do something bold, something different. Change yourself. I'm so excited for all the money that you're about to make. You can find all episodes of The Reality Revolution at therealityrevolution.com. And welcome to The Reality Revolution.